with Christy, it was much, much deeper. This whole dependent and infantile part of me was coming out. I mean, I wouldn't have, again, this is psychoanalytic language. I was moving into a regression that was terrifying because I had been trained by my mother and it was my nature and it was what had worked for me to really, approach things in, you know, as an independent person. I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. I can function whatever happens. And while that, while I explored a little bit of that with Lane, it was only very slight and we never talked about it. With Christy, she would actually make me aware of it and I would become aware of my own need for her and withdraw. With Christy, it was like immediate that I knew there was much greater complexity going on, a level of complexity that I couldn't have handled in my 20s. And we locked horns almost immediately.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Professor Joan Peters. Professor Peters is a professor emeritus of literature and writing at California State University at California. And our conversation today revolves around her recently published memoir entitled Untangling, a Memoir of Psychoanalysis. And what this is a description of two lengthy analyses at very different points in her life, in her 20s and in her 60s, with two very different analysts, with two very different approaches. And she shares with us, really in remarkable and beautifully written detail, what that process was like for her, how she understood it. These are her words, after all. And the usefulness of the two different models that the two analysts used, basically, and we go into this in some detail, the second analyst used their relationship as the medium of discovery and repair. And the first analyst used uncovering memories in the extra transference as the vehicle of healing and growth. And both seemed to be uniquely useful for who she was at those two periods of time. It not only makes for fascinating personal reading, but can be used as for purposes of teaching in our field to unpack, again, these are the analyst Sands words, but nevertheless, to unpack how we understand the impact of what we do and don't do for patients. She has presented this work at the American Psychoanalytic Association, and she will be doing it again at the upcoming meetings, where this book will be the subject of a panel discussion. She writes a blog for Psychology Today. She contributed an essay on dream interpretation for Psychoanalytic Inquiry, and she is a guest editor of a special issue of Psychoanalytic Inquiry having to do with the patient experience, that is, collecting memoir material about people's analytic experiences. It's a whole new way for us to listen to ourselves, to hear from our analysands, to learn from it, and also to let the community at large get a feel for the work we do. I hope you find this as moving and important as I did. Here is my conversation with Joan Peters. Welcome to the podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
The psychotherapy trajectories that individuals go through over the course of their life are very varied. The most straightforward one is when someone has a need that they identify as wanting help with and wanting to be in contact with a professional about. They make contact with that person. They meet with that person. And if they have a sense that the connection is dependable and solid and promising, they stay with that person for a period of time. And they, at some point, finish their work together, most often. And they leave with a sense that their life has been changed, either in ways that are good or even sometimes in ways that are profound. That's one pathway, perhaps an ideal, but it does happen. What also happens not infrequently is that people sort of bounce around in various supportive, superficial treatments, and they are left not having a sense of being understood, being recognized, a state of mind that they're not able to engage the clinician around. And so they leave those treatments, and sometimes they find themselves in the offices of dynamically focused, dynamically trained clinicians, and they have a sense of being understood in ways they didn't even know they wanted to be understood. And they engage with that treatment, and again, it ends either with positive changes in their life or at times profoundly important changes in their life. And it's also the case that people sometimes start off meeting a dynamic therapist, and for any one of a number of reasons, it is a misattuned relationship, and the patient leaves, and they can seek out supportive treatments, at times with medication, and are left feeling satisfied with that. And then there are two other larger models. One is that people start an analysis even at early points in their life and are satisfied with the work, and it concludes. And then later in their life, they return to the same analyst to continue and further the work. And when that happens, often the work is even richer based on the person's first analysis and the new abilities they have that grew from that, from their own life experiences, and also, of course, from the clinical maturation of their analyst. But now we come to your journey. And this is a journey that you really remarkably describe for the reader in your memoir called Untangling, a memoir of psychoanalysis. And in it, you describe two treatments. And we're going to discuss these treatments. The first was with one analyst in your 20s, as you will hear, as you will share with us. And the later was much later in your life. They were both analyses of a very different sort, with two very different individuals. Now, it is no secret that analysts are all very different, and no two treatments are the same. But these two treatments are different not only because the analysts are different, but their theoretical model, such that you present it, and that's what we're basing this on, is profoundly different. And the pivot point that distinguishes the two is that the role of the relationship between patient and analyst is understood and experienced and shared and enriched differently in these two treatments. And that made all the difference. And I don't think we're here to say which one was better for you at the different points in your life. We can talk about that. But
simply put, the second treatment opened up the relationship between the two of you, and the first one did not. And before I invite you to share with us what your life was like that led you to start your first treatment, I want to read just a couple of sentences to orient the listener to what we're about to hear. And you write, and this is on page one, "This is a memoir of psychoanalysis, two psychoanalyses, in fact. My first at age 28 and my second at 67, each lasting the better part of a decade. Though separated by so many years, they form one continuous odyssey through the caverns of my mind and the mysteries of the analytic process." And you go on to say, "During my years working with your first analyst, Lane, she was the sun I revolved around. Her kind understanding made my emotional growth possible. Her insights were the inspiration to explore my strangely shrouded past and to try new ways of being in the present. However, Lane and I never talked about our relationship or the analysis itself." Joan, you want to start us off?
Yes, yeah. What brought me to Lane was I'm laughing because I stumbled into analysis, really. I was in a happy moment in my life, an unexpected time of joy. I had found and fallen in love for the first time. I was living with my lover. I had a great job. And that's in contrast to previously I had had a marriage with someone who was like a brother to me, which was sort of the only kind of love I knew. And I was thrilled. I thought everything was great, solved all the problems. And that wasn't the case because I was waking up at night with nightmares all the time, as I always had. I had restless leg syndrome. I had night terrors. And I never thought anything of it because I could perform very well in the daytime. I was getting my PhD. I finished my thesis. I was very high achieving. And finally, my lover said to me, "Joan, people don't wake up screaming two and three times a week. You need to see someone." So I asked around. I found the name of what I thought was a therapist and had no idea what the difference between therapy and analysis was. And I ended up in Lane's office, and she was a woman who was just starting out in her practice. And she had a supervisor who she would bring the tape recordings of our sessions to. And that was all fine with me. And so we started off and we began with the nightmares. And she saw in the nightmares, which were repeated, it was one theme over and over, people chasing me. Often they were women. They would pin me down and inject me with something that would take away my physical power so I couldn't fight them, and they would kill me. And that would be when I'd wake up screaming. And little by little, she began to ask me about my childhood, and I could give her almost no information about my early childhood, which was cut off from my a known childhood before and after 5 years old. And what we discovered is that my father died when I was two, and it was gruesome. My mother had no money. His family abandoned her. We lived in a small apartment where certainly at 2 years old, I could see and respond to the fact that this man was wasting away and dying, and she was injecting him with morphine. And those injections were what Lane leapt on. And little by little, again, I got this information from my mother. And as she began to put together that these nightmares were about this terrifying time in my childhood, and when he finally died, which was really a disappearance, because nobody explained. My mother left to go to work eight hours a day. She was a model, but she, she probably was gone more like 10, given New York subways. So I think I was you know, traumatized during that time. And Lane began to unravel the dream, interpret it for me. And at the moment when she gave it to me full and talked about, you know, you were the angel of death. It was my birth when my father was diagnosed. And the family fell apart after that. And my mother not only disappeared, but she withdrew emotionally. She was just obviously at 26, overwhelmed. So when Lane presented this interpretation to me, I didn't even, you know, it seemed like somebody else's, I don't know, fairy story or something. And yet my nightmares disappeared. And that was for me the moment when I discovered and understood what the unconscious is. And that was from there, we descended into deeper and deeper places in my unconscious to really understand what happened. She often sent me out to interview relatives I didn't even know on his side of the family, my side of the family, to put together what happened and why there was such silence about it. And we ended up solving the mystery.
Let me quote how you write about that. You say, for me, the only relevant fact about my father was this: dead is dead. And yet gradually in analysis, other feelings began to emerge. As different versions of the story began to assemble itself, so too did different versions of me. Pentimento, the painting beneath the painting, was becoming visible. And even the way you describe it just now, you know, the mystery was solved. It sounds like it is like a Sherlock Holmes story. And that was absolutely both the strength and the limitation of that treatment, because it is a little bit of a Hollywood notion that, there's a mystery and we have to solve it. And when we solve it, all the pieces fall into place. And that clearly was of enormous benefit to you. And yet.
Yes.
Now, let me read further about what you wrote, and we can talk about the strengths and limitations. And you and I have, this is not a surprise conversation for the two of us. And I have gone over this. Okay. You write, despite Lane's implicit belief that I had probably loved my father and was devastated by his loss, I wasn't an easy sell. Whenever I talked about him with her, I was cocky. My dearly departed was nowhere as far as I could tell. Then you go on to say, anger, I was to understand, was easier to bear than heartbreak. According to Lane, the anger I felt towards my father and his family, in fact, my constant resentment towards all the adults in my family, protected me from feeling the hurt of their inadequate care. Now, this is, and there's another paragraph I want to read in a moment that elaborates the same notion, where there is undoubtedly something very valuable in here for you to learn that you used anger as a defense against hurt, something us humans are quite familiar with.
Yeah.
But you start introducing the idea that anger, I was to understand, that it was sort of a cognitive discovery of understanding, that Lane told you that, and you were to understand it. You go on to say in that vein on the next page, with Lane, I was learning the language of psychoanalysis. Nothing was simply crazy. Everything had meaning. Once I confessed to Lane that I'd long imagined that if I slit my arms open, black vermin would stream out, an idea so repulsive, it sickened me. To her, it made perfect sense. Quote, something horrible inside you explained why your mother wasn't loving. Children blame themselves rather than risk anger at the parent they desperately need. Now, again, for me, this paragraph contains a very rich description of the engagement that you had with Lane. On the one hand, you were able to discover a sense of darkness, of evilness, of foulness inside yourself, which is a powerful and life-transforming thing for someone to become aware that they're living with. And she accepts that. She is not repulsed, unlike your anticipation, perhaps, of her. She accepted you for that. And at the same time, the way you phrase it is, I was learning the language of psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis is not a language. It's a methodology to help you learn your language. And this brought to my attention the many phrases you use in this book, specifically in relation to Lane, your first analyst. You will say, according to Lane, or Lane informed me, or as Lane explained, or as Lane pointed out, all of which suggested to me, and when I mentioned this to you, it seemed accurate to you, that it did reflect the sort of the cognitive outside your experience nature of the work. And let me ask you about that, how that sits with you.
Yeah, it's in the passages you read, it sounds cerebral, but in fact, with each, it's like the cerebral protected me enough so that I could allow myself to experience these deeper layers of my being, my response to the world. So, for example, during one interview with a relative she was my cousin, I had never met her, and she had known my father well. And the first thing she did, we sat down at a restaurant table, she took out his business card and pushed it towards me across the table. I looked at this card. It was the first time I had seen any physical reality related to my dead father. And in a total surprise to me, I burst into tears. And I was someone who almost never cried. In fact, I could only remember one other time when I did cry in my life. And I think that was the release. That was me confronting all the feelings that I actually had about this father of mine who disappeared and whom we never spoke of again. And when I talk about the language of psychoanalysis, I mean the interpretations, the idea of the unconscious, the way we protect ourselves with defenses that cover over these emotions. I had all of that. Those were the tools that I could hold on to, the safety. It was like holding on to something that connected me with Lane so I could go out and feel all of these things that I had never felt before in our Sherlock Holmes search for my past, and just understanding my past, understanding how abandoned I felt by my mother, how it explained a lifelong aloneness that and isolation that I had never understood.
So it's a deepening, like you say, of pentimento. It really revealed lower layers.
Yes.
In your life and in yourself in a useful way.
More than useful. It was life transforming. I was a very intellectual, cerebral person. That was how I was in the world. And with my lover, Blanche, and with my new discovery of all of these feelings about my family, what I had felt about my mother, what I had felt about my very loving and kind brother, how he was the love that I could rely on growing up, and that it was no accident I chose a husband who was like a brother. So all of these things started to make sense in a life that I had previously understood nothing about. So my behavior was an enigma to me. And now I was understanding the feelings connected with the behavior.
You mentioned Blanche, and she forms an important part of the initial part of the book and your life. You were married to Rick, and you go to a conference, and you hear Blanche give a talk, and you write in the book, talk about adoration. by the end of the 10-day residency, I said to Blanche and meant it, "Nothing else matters to me but you." If I'd been thinking rationally, my position would have seemed preposterous, even to me. But in my besotted mind, it made perfect sense. I believed that this was not just passion of the flesh, but something more like the mystical ravishment that had drawn me to study metaphysical poetry in graduate school. At the time I fell in love with Blanche, I saw no connection between my relationship with her and my relationship with my mother. But in analysis, I did begin to see one. Now, many clinicians listening to this will be interested, obviously, in the details and the imaginings associated with it. But in particular, you go from Blanche to your mother, and one would wonder where was your analyst in your mind in this, especially even more so given that it was a woman analyst, that it was your being besotted by Blanche a displacement from your being besotted by your analyst. And what the beauty of your work allows us to see is that that wasn't elaborated between you and Lane, but certainly emerged in full force in your second analysis, where you were quite, to use your word, besotted with your woman analyst.
Once again, yeah, but there we really did tease it out and talk about it and fight about it and so on. With Lane, I think the truth is that I was a very fragile 20-something, and she saw in me someone who could just fall apart again very easily. And a lot of her work with me was supportive. And I was besotted with Lane in a different way from Blanche, although it was both maternal. What I was discovering at that time in my life was the immensity of my need for my mother, my love for her, my fury at her. She was an inaccessible mother. She was not a loving mother. She was bitter and tough and difficult. And in falling in love with Blanche, I don't think I was, my erotic life had not even come out, because it was too dangerous. And men were too dangerous. I think particularly because I felt my father had abandoned me, before in his morphine, stupor. He threw a shoe at me once. I mean, he was scary, and he was dying and wasting away. And I think men were so terribly frightening that when this women's festival where I met Blanche gave me the opportunity to feel erotic feelings for women, that became a whole area of safe erotic, exploring desire. I had never really done with men, and men previously were the only opportunity, since I didn't even know what a lesbian was until the women's movement. So I think that that was part of this whole emerging of my feelings about my mother. And Lane, for me, was the good mother. She was perfect. Everything she gave me, all of her kind responses to me, I felt such love from her. Not something that, not love exactly, but it felt like care and availability and attunement. And I reveled in it, and it became, she was, as I say, the perfect mother, the good mother. Not that I would have used that language. So right. I think she and Blanche had two phases, two parts of my relationship to maternal love.
You go on to describe in the book that after Blanche, you had a period of frenetic heterosexuality. You characterized it as saying, that intensity of need was like nothing I ever felt. I could not stop. But indeed, you did stop and have been in a 40-year-long marriage with Peter, which is worthy of
note. Yes.
You summarize your first analysis by saying the following. Looking back, the remarkable revelations about the sources of my despair seem to account for only part of its power. The crucial part, as you just said, that I believe was Lane herself, what I thought of as her lavishly unwavering care. Lane gave me what felt like maternal love. Each infusion at every session and in every telephone call strengthened my ability to bond with others and with life itself. If there were different, more penetrating kinds of analysis, I didn't know about them. If Lane had misgivings about her good mother role, I didn't know about that either. What I still believe is that Lane's exclusively supportive form of analysis was good medicine for me. You go on to say, introducing your second analysis, you write, the second analysis took up a question I'd never considered before. Who are we to one another as analyst and patient? So clearly and beautifully said, who are we to one another as analyst and patient? So the question one might ask is, so, well, why don't I ask you to elaborate that, then we'll sort of introduce the second piece of the book and the second phase of your life. You
well,
have reflections?
I will fill in a little bit to make it comprehensible. I did have a period, a long period, that lasted almost a couple of years of frenetic promiscuity with men. And I think that for one thing, I hadn't had pretty much anything to do sexually with men for years, five years or more. So they became more and more unknown to me. And I think that the sexuality was, for one thing, a release of all of the desire that I had had to suppress in order to feel safe, because men were far too frightening to me. And far too men in a romantic relationship. I had men friends, just like my brother, who was my dear friend. But men in romantic relationships would have been inconceivable. I was angry at men. I really felt the inequality of male female. I wanted nothing to do. So this was my way of getting to know men and getting to know my own desire, my own sexual being in its fullness. I had explored that part of me with women, and here I was exploring that part of me with men. So by the time I met Peter, I was comfortable with men. I was comfortable in romantic relationship to them, in pure sexual relationship to them, in friendship with them. And I kind of think of it as being, and Lane, without her encouragement constantly, without her analysis of why I was so frightened by men and what my father, the experience with my father and my mother, because she was furious at men herself, how that affected me. I was able, with her help, to open up that possibility for myself of a relationship with a man. And then I met Peter. So I don't think it could have happened without analysis. I don't think I was psychologically available to that. And my relationship with Lane was her reading me, knowing where to support, and also her interpretations. That's what often just liberated me.
The way you summarized it is you came to discover that, quote, men are just people, as scared and fragile as women. Indeed.
Yes, that's right.
So the question then comes up, why not leave well enough alone? Life was going well. But you write, I was at a critical juncture in my life. My teaching career was drawing to a close, and on the threshold of the last quarter of my life, I wanted one more great adventure. I wanted to understand the currents of compulsion that seemed to run through almost all my activities. I wanted to know the meaning of my unrelenting insomnia. At 68, I was on the brink of old age, acutely aware that I would soon feel death so close, it could come before dinner. If not for me, then for a peer, as the obits made clear. Before my own appeared, I wanted this last big thing, and I was getting it. Now, this introduces Christy, your second analyst. Yeah. And I want to add, before we dive into this, that one of the many things that is lovely and useful about this book of yours is that you invited, and Christy agreed, to write an afterword. She wrote a really beautiful piece that, if you don't mind the crudeness, is worth the price of the book, it really describing what it was like for her to treat you. Now, if you haven't read the book, you don't realize yet what treating you was like. We're about to unpack that. Why don't you start reading on page 84 to introduce what treating you was like?
All the while, Christy formed an almost separate relationship with a part of me I didn't know when I began this analysis, and whose qualities I would not have recognized in myself had she not teased them from my nightmares and difficulties. As their defender, she argued for the basic humanness of what I found unacceptable in myself. Though I always understood her perspective, these were qualities so threatening to me that I ignored whatever fraction of them peeked out in unguarded moments. Since they didn't exist for me, I didn't buy her theory. But like a snake charmer, Christy played her tune so hypnotically that after years of her painstaking work, this unacknowledged part of me bobbing and weaving rose to the surface. It was a triumph that I could now acknowledge the banished part of me that Christy coaxed from the psychic den. She would say that the greater triumph was my acknowledging her as an object of care, the term she used when I complained about how long this analysis was taking, which I did often. Raising her voice, eyes wide, she said, "Joan, it took you 2 years to even think of me as an object of care."
Let's pause on that, because it warrants our listening carefully. You talk about parts of me I didn't know when I began this analysis, the unacknowledged part of me, you say. That's a very hard thing to communicate to someone who hasn't been through the experience of discovering unknown parts of oneself, because they are unknown. A teacher told me a very long time ago, one of the challenges of this work is that the unconscious is really unconscious. That you can't ask a person, well, why do you really feel that way? Because you have to understand it's really unknown to the person. And yet when you're in the hands of someone who's talented, they can acquaint you with these parts of yourself that have been unknown. What was that like for you?
Frightening. Unlike Lane, I mean, I was dependent on Lane. I would call her between sessions, and if I didn't hear her voice, I thought I was going to die. But with Christy, it was much, much deeper. This whole dependent, infantile part of me was coming out. I mean, I wouldn't have, again, this is psychoanalytic language. I was moving into a regression that was terrifying, because I had been trained by my mother, and it was my nature, and it was what had worked for me to really approach things. As an independent person, I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. I can function whatever happens. And while I explored a little bit of that with Lane, it was only very slight, and we never talked about it. with Christy, she would actually make me aware of it, and I would become aware of my own need for her and withdraw. With Christy, it was like immediate that I knew there was much greater complexity going on, a level of complexity that I couldn't have handled in my 20s. And we locked horns almost immediately. If she made a move toward me that was slightly too intimate or slightly too loving or slightly too emotional, I would push her away. My relationship with her was, she was a person with certain skill set, and she was using that to decipher what was going on in my brain. I didn't have that kind of resistance with Lane. I was too young. I didn't even know what I was getting into. With Christy, I must have sensed it immediately, that there was a whole other stratum of connection between the two of us that I didn't want to go near. And I did not admit that she was an object of care. So it was tough going, because I wanted to control the analysis. I would only go in certain directions. I would often accuse her of having nothing to say. Her interpretations were bland. I was getting nothing out of this. Where was she? She was withdrawing from me. And really what she was experiencing was me pushing her away, not hearing her interpretations, not allowing her to come close to me. So it was from the beginning, it was a much tougher analysis. And every time we did come together, there was a much, much greater, deeper connection and satisfaction for me, because intimacy that she was offering me, the level of human connection that she was actually teaching me, and I had not experienced except with Peter. He was my one totally safe place. But she was offering me a way of experiencing human connection in other people that I had never had. And then to actually talk about it, to say what it is, which, you know, in my family, you know, we were brought up never to put words to whatever was going on between and among us. So that was revelatory.
Joan, you may not appreciate it, but the last 3-4 minutes of what you've been saying can serve as a masterclass in psychoanalysis for somebody who wants to know what it is and to appreciate its power, its riskiness, and how essential it is to be in good hands. So I thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for telling me.
Can you read further on the next page, starting with this, which has just strange union?
This was such a strange union, though. It contained elements of friendship and was unquestionably parental, but it went well beyond those familiar bonds and into its own ineffable one. It registered sensitivity so acute that sometimes in sessions we'd switch so quickly back and forth from harmony to discord. I saw us as jazz musicians in an improvisational duet, veering from cacophony to melody, from tonic to dominant and back again. Whatever this partnership was, it now had its own existence, the way a marriage exists, as in this marriage was a happy one, or their marriage was a disaster. The relationship itself had become a character with its own identity and trajectory.
And you go on to describe that in beautiful detail when you say, I was reliving my whole childhood in our relationship. I was reliving my whole childhood in our relationship. And you go on to say that I learned was transference, the magic bullet of psychoanalysis, though on that April afternoon, overwrought and certain as I was about Christy, Thrilled by her imminent appearance, I believed my elation was about this magical person, no past included. No past included. And that is one of the powerful moments and frightening moments at times for both parties. When it is so alive in the present, in the literal moment, the idea that there is a past and a history to this has no affective meaning. As I've been told in such circumstances, when trying to separate the present from the past, the person said to me, "You are my past," which is a challenging moment. I guess leave it at that.
Yeah.
You go on to describe that you went on a meditation retreat, and this was in the deepening part of your treatment, and you came back from this meditation retreat, and you write, "I realized how connected I was to Christy, and she for me for these past 2 years. I saw it. Christy and I as a pair engaged in some delicate call and response venture, scripted and spontaneous, mysterious like this retreat was. The very thought of her set off a gush of gratitude for her patience in the face of my surliness. I was so taken aback by my tender feelings towards this person I previously thought of as no more than a coworker. Then I rushed to my computer and wrote her a personal email. I never did that before. Nonetheless, I unashamedly described to her how much she meant to me and apologized for having created such a distance between us. Maybe it took a week of meditation to get me there, but I was there now with Christy."
Yeah, that's much earlier, of course, in my relationship with her before I fell, before madly in love with her. But early in that relationship, when I was keeping my distance all the time, I did have this experience at the retreat, and I wrote her a letter of love and appreciation and acknowledgement of our that we actually had a relationship and that I felt close to her. And that took all the courage I had. And I was waiting for her email response because this was all so new to me. And the only response I got was like two words: "Thanks for sending it." And I was devastated. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I had just come to understand these emotions. And when I got to her office after the retreat, steam was coming out of my ears. I was furious. I was pacing up and down and saying, how could you respond like that? It was so cold. It was nothing. And I poured my heart out to you. It's what you've always said you wanted. And I did it. And I was really, and what was so beautiful about her response is she was just watching me. And I could see there was a kind of puzzlement in her eyes, but I didn't know what that was. And then she said, "Oh, I understand. It's as if I had said to you, thank you for sharing. Like maybe I even disapproved of you sending me that." And she was absolutely right. And I felt she was able to shift into, she told me how sorry she was and that it was really a miscommunication. She didn't understand what I needed from her in response. And she felt sorry. And that sorry was like, it was as if she was saying, "I'm sorry for every wrong that had ever happened to me." I wasn't used to people being able to say, "I'm sorry," and acknowledge that they've hurt you. I wasn't used to telling people that they could hurt me. In fact, it all came out as anger again, because that was my my mode of communication.
Do you have the sense, either at the time or looking back, that what you were looking for was some response from her in kind about her need and love for you?
No, I think what I was looking for was an acknowledgement that she welcomed those feelings that I was expressing to her, and that she appreciated the what it took to send that, and it was really the welcome I was looking for. And I think that was so important to me, because you know, when I was a child, my love wasn't welcome. I wasn't responded to. So I think that was it. I wouldn't have expected her to respond in kind.
Tell us about what you came to call the anti-force.
I think the best way to describe that is it was my defense system. So generally, in that exchange with Christy, it worked very quickly. She apologized, and that apology, and I could tell she really felt bad for not noticing what was needed in that. But if she disappointed me, I would immediately go into withdrawal and anger, and I would which would negate our entire relationship. Everything that happened in the past that connected us was null and void. And that was the anti-force. And the anti-force, really, to be more explicit, goes back to a period of more than 5 years in my adolescence when I was in a schizoid state. I heard voices, and these voices instructed me how to not connect with other people because I was special and being saved for a fate that was would reveal itself, and that I mustn't love other people. I mustn't have too much to do. I wasn't a regular teenager doing silly things. I was always in this exalted state, and that was the anti-force. And it would take me over. It would explain what was going on for me in my life. It would protect me from being hurt by not getting what I needed. It really protected me from the anticipated rejections, hurts, and overwhelm that I might feel in the world, in ordinary Congress. And that became the anti-force. I could always retreat there to protect myself.
It protected you from your desires also, no?
Absolutely. Yeah. I wouldn't risk caring that Christy disappointed me. She meant nothing to me. It was over. It wasn't so over that I didn't come back for the next session, mind you.
Sure, right. I understand that, right. Unfortunately. Let me read a paragraph, and it's on page 158, which is relevant for what I'm going to say about it, because it's late in the book. And you write, "So quickly did I move from dependency to frenzy that it seemed as if an entirely new person emerged from my psyche and was about to take over. My need for Christy intensified to the point where I never had enough of her and was always afraid of losing her. No matter how pleasurable my nearly retired life was, at night I felt alone, unprotected and panicky, even with Peter sleeping beside me and our dogs at our feet. I would rush to the computer to email her so I could feel that she was still there, like conjuring a ghost. In the morning I thought how pitiful. If I traveled even for just a weekend, I was scared there would be nothing between us in our next session. I never ever needed anyone that much, not even Blanche, around whom I had enough control to at least hide my insecurity. Whoever I had become, I didn't know how to handle being her. I didn't want to be her. As for Christy, her colossal importance in my life now gave her a frightening power over me, while my obsession with her intensified with that power." So, A, that's a beautifully written and painfully written and listened to for me paragraph. But I mention it's at page 158 because there aren't that many more pages to the book. And as I was reading this, I thought to myself, we're approaching the end of this book and you are in the midst of this frenzy. What's going to happen over the next 20 or 30 pages that's going to resolve this? Because I assume the book is not going to end with your being in this condition. So what could possibly occur in you or between the two of you that will lead not necessarily to happily ever after, but something more coherent? So I ask you that question.
It's a great question. And I had never noticed how little time there was between that frenzy and the conclusion. But I think that that frenzy was for me an incredible breakthrough, because I had never allowed myself to be that vulnerable to another person. Even Peter, even my husband, I had never felt those wild and erratic emotions in that way. I had never allowed myself to be in this mysterious connection with another human being, that it was so intense. And I think she would say, and she has said many times to me, that so much work between us went into allowing that. And it really was close to the end. And what happened after that was a tremendous rupture, the biggest rupture of our rupture and repair relationship. And it was only a couple of weeks later when she announced she was moving away and we would resume on Zoom. And that was, and she was retiring, except she would finish my analysis. And that was just infuriating. Again, the anti-force took over. I withdrew. I was furious. Not only that, her husband, who was critically ill and was in emergency situation constantly, her teenage son was acting out. She was obviously in a state herself, and she was contemplating moving, and she withdrew. In my estimation, she was not herself in the engagement with me. She was withdrawn. She was cold. I was getting more and more furious. I was constantly accusing her. She was just saying, it's all in your head, essentially. Nothing's wrong. I'm my usual self. And we fought this way for weeks after the moment that you read of delighted love for this person. And finally, I thought this analysis was going to end, because I was not able to tolerate her being there in and not being there. And she said she was going on a retreat herself, and that she would get back to me afterwards. And from the retreat, she wrote me an incredible letter explaining that she had so slowly become so overwhelmed with her life that she hadn't even realized that she had indeed withdrawn from me. And again, she offered a deep apology. And that was the most beautiful thing anyone ever gave me emotionally, for the particular way that I had been wounded and disappointed in my life. It filled all of that. And we were able to reconnect and continue on to the end of the analysis, which wrapped up pretty quickly. Another year after that of really just finalizing things. And it taught me something about the nature of, you know, that this was happening in her life. It was totally understandable. And how do we as people allow each other those private responses that we have to tolerate if we're going to sustain a connection? And it told me something about bonding and what it meant, and allowed me to notice that my mother, for all her lack of presence, never abandoned me, always stayed bonded with me in some way. And I just began to see the world differently, existentially differently.
You have a big smile on your face. I want the listener to know that. I can see that, but they can't. It's a lovely smile. The other point you seem to be making is that she shared with you a great deal about her personal life. You just listed a few of the elements, her husband's illness, her child.
Yes.
And you're implying, if I hear you right, that you were able to use that to understand her as a separate person, worthy of caring and understanding on your own part, something that advanced your own maturation. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Absolutely, exactly. I don't think I would have felt it was as complete an analysis had I not had that period of really seeing her as a separate person, and her sharing with me was sprinkled throughout the analysis, little bits. So I was able to put together, you know, by the end, a real understanding of her as a person and how we related and why, how we connected and what the disconnects were and why. And I felt that was a tremendous, treasured part of analysis for me.
The clinicians who are listening, there's a whole subject that we are touching, we are glancing upon, and that is the subject of self-revelation that we will have to take up at another time. But I want to announce this as a contribution to the subject, your firsthand report of it. Before I ask you to read,
I know it's controversial.
We're also hearing from the patient firsthand that it was useful. And, you know, one could have abstracted theoretical controversy, and that's fine. But it's a different level of truth when we hear from an individual who was involved in it that they found it deeply important. And I just want to italicize that as an important piece of information. Before I ask you to read the final paragraph from the book, tell us just a little bit about your writing this book. I mean, it's a remarkable compilation. How did you do it? How did you come up with the idea? With whom did you share it? What was it like?
Well, first of all, Christy came up with the idea. I had been writing to her in the middle of the night when I had these bouts of night terrors and restless legs and continuing nightmares occasionally, not the ones that I had with Lane, but different kinds. And I was writing it. I began to write like volumes in the middle of the night. I didn't expect answers, but I knew that we would talk about it next session. And one time she afterwards said to me in session, "Have you ever thought about writing about psychoanalysis?" And she knew that I had been trying in a way to find my voice in my writing for many years, and that I'd struggled with that. And as soon as she said it, I knew that this was my subject, that this was what I could write about. In fact, it shocked me to think about it, but I had spent a lifetime thinking psychoanalytically, and I had seen several different doctors. I mean, Lane and Christy were my long analyses, but I had even seen other people. And I knew exactly where I wanted to begin, and it just started to come so quickly. And I also knew it was tied to resolving and concluding my analysis. It was as I wrote about it, I felt I was mastering it, because this analysis with Christy had so knocked my socks off, had so destabilized me in so many ways, in opening me up emotionally to the world, and really uncovering parts of me I didn't know at all, that I didn't feel, you know, I felt I was still in the whirlwind of it. And writing it made me feel as if I had somehow turned it into a piece of music. I had found its form. I had found its structure and the center of it, and was able to, in a way, give it back to Christy. And that was my gift to her.
Yes, this is
what we've done. Look at what we've done.
And part of your gift is how beautifully you conclude the book. So let me ask you to read that on page 185, the bottom.
On a recent hike in the early morning, when I was sitting by a brook and closed my eyes for a few moments, I suddenly heard the water in all its intricacy, its tones and volume, the places where it frothed or flowed over and around the rocks, each burble unique in its timbre. Its current sounded so much louder than when I was looking around at the oaks and calling to my dogs, that eventually the sound and really the brook itself felt as if it were inside me. Analysis is like that. In the distractions of everyday life, your deepest being is in the background, making itself heard only softly now and then, more audibly in meditation, and often piercingly in times of crisis or great joy. But in analysis, like closing your eyes by the brook, the deep self comes to the fore. You hear it in all its intricacy, with your analyst there to help you understand it. Analysis unraveled the tightly wound layers of me one by one, until finally in the center, I discovered myself, whole, the known and hidden parts in equal measure. My great problems are over. My restless legs are mostly quiet, and I often sleep through the night like a normal person. While I was getting used to this new life of mine, I still had weekly sessions with Christy, but our talks were a luxury, not a need. The last ones were about our sadness at not seeing one another anymore, though we promised ourselves visits when she came to town. As much as I miss her, I feel like an injured bird that's been nursed back to health and tossed into the air by loving hands. Is that all? As minutely as I've described these two analyses, I feel as if I'd left half unsaid. And yet, as Christy might say, it's enough.
It's enough only if one reads the book. And let me use that to encourage people. It really is a profound undertaking. Everyone's journey is different. Everyone's life story is different. But rarely will we find it so beautifully expressed as you did, Joan. And I thank you, A, for myself, for the opportunity to read it, for the opportunity to spend time with you, and also for your contribution to our field. Because as I said at the beginning, so often people will come to our offices and they will, and if it works, and it doesn't always, but when it does, and they discover, like you say, parts of themselves they hadn't anticipated, they will often say, how is it that it's so random that I ended up here?
Yeah.
This should be better known, that this kind of treatment for people like me is available to make such a difference, just as you described with your two analysts.
I hope it does. Thank you. Thank you for having me and for helping me to understand my book.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.